Merci encore d'être revenu à la tâche. Poser la question. Les politiques publiques sont des crimes. Oh. But now for something a little different. You've read them in the papers. You've seen them on TV. But how do the media and public opinion actually affect policymaking in Canada? And I'm very happy to chair our final panel is L. Ian McDonald, editor of Policy Options, the publication of the Institute for Research in Public Policy. And he's promised to get to the bottom of this conundrum for us with his distinguished panel. Let me take this opportunity to announce that Ian will begin a visiting appointment in media and communications at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada next fall. And we're very happy to welcome him here, but this is a test. So I just say that so that at the end of the panel we can decide whether you can, you have signed the letter, but if we ratify the letter, I guess that's what we could do. All right, take it away, Ian.
Thank you, Andy. Well, this is a time management issue so that we can be finished by Friday, which is a traditional aperitif hour in Montreal, so don't worry, we'll watch the time. The first question we want to ask with this group is this distinguished panel is, do media and public opinion really matter? And we've all agreed that the presentations will be shortened a little bit to about 5-7 minutes so that we can have time for a wraparound on another crisis that's going on that's related to public policy, and it's the crisis in the news media. And we're going to have spend some time talking about that in a wraparound session before we get to the Q&A with a really outstanding group. First of all, going from left to right, Chris Waddell, who is the Associate Director of Journalism at the Carleton G. School, Journalism School in Ottawa, and former Parliamentary Bureau Chief of CC Television, previously a political writer with the Globe and Mail. Nick Nanos, President and CEO of Nanos Research in Ottawa, official pollster to CPAC, Policy Options, RMS, among others, one of the country's outstanding leading pollsters, and he's also a visiting professor in research at SUNY, State University of New York, at Buffalo. Sandra Buckler, whom some of you may have seen on election night with Lloyd Robertson at CTV, is a former director of communications through Prime Minister Harper. She was the guard of the gate for a long time and had the very unenviable and difficult task of having two clients, the Prime Minister and the Press Secretary, whose agendas are not always compatible. And she's going to address some of those challenges, I think. And finally, Alain Dubuc, who's a prominent author and columnist at La Presse and winner of the prestigious Hyman Solomon Award in journalism. So why don't we start with Chris, and we'll take it from there. Chris?
Okay, thank you very much, Ian. Ian has told us all, as you said, about 5 to 7 minutes. So I'll try and do mine in my 5 to 7 minutes. I'm sure I'll get elbowed by him if I don't. First of all, a couple of quick apologies or whatever. I missed all the session up until now. I had a class yesterday morning and one again this morning. So I may say some things that other people have said. Maybe not. I hope not. And the second is when I'm going to talk a little bit about do media and what did media matter in public policy formulation. And my comments will be about the English language media in Canada, not really about the French language media. I don't follow the French language media enough to really feel that I have much to add on that issue. But on the major issue of media matter in public policy, I'd say increasingly not. Over the last 2 decades, the mainstream media has broadly abandoned coverage of politics and public policy in this country. It's now reached the point, with a few exceptions, where mass media or mainstream media is simply not a serious player in public policy. It's made itself that way mostly by its own actions, and let me walk through quickly how that's actually happened. I'll use Ottawa as an example, but the situation is just bad, if not worse, in provincial capital across the country. Beginning in the last recession in the early 1990s, there's been regular cutbacks in the number of reporters there are in Ottawa. In that recession 15 years ago, mid-sized newspapers like Hamilton, Spectator, The Windsor Star, London Free Press, Regina New Post, Suskin Star, Phoenix, all shut down their Ottawa bureaus and reporters. Broadcasters like BCTV stopped having reporters in Ottawa as well. Even in the times in the last decade and a half, the cuts have continued at both private and publicly owned media organizations, so that there are now fewer and fewer reporters covering government public policy and politics. Partly this was done by the media under the mantra of convergence. In other words, the same organization owning print and broadcast media and also getting involved in the internet and sharing reporters and news operations. I could tell stories about that maybe later on. This has proven to be almost utter failures in media strategy. At the same time as the number of reporters and journalists has declined, the demands on their time has grown largely thanks to the internet and the need for everyone either to be filing for multiple outlets or filing more frequently as the internet's become a wire service that everyone has to be involved, whether you're a broadcaster or a print media organization. Fewer reporters, many organizations now just have enough people to meet their daily demands, so there's no ability for research, reading, attending committee hearings, finding out much about anything that doesn't generate a story a day. The media's response to these increased pressures has largely been to eliminate specialist reporters who've taken the time to study and understand issues and the people in their beat areas. Precisely the people who report knowledge and context about public policy don't really exist anymore. Everyone's become a general climate reporter, covering Canada's mission in Afghanistan one day, demands for changes to EI next, the appearance of the CRTC chair at a Commons committee the day after that, the auto industry bailout the next day, and then reporting breathless latest public opinion poll results at the end of the week. It's quite literally true that there are fewer and fewer reporters knowing less and less about more and more that they're being asked to cover. Their research is frequently the last few stories you can grab from a Google search before rushing out the door. And we all know one of the Internet's strengths is turning fiction into fact, so that doesn't really hurt on that level. The result is what we need today. If you're a journalist and you know little about the complexities of an issue, you can always do two things. You can write about conflict, you can write about personality, or do stories about conflict or personality. So, to a large extent, I would argue much of the media coverage of politics and public policy has become that, conflict and personality. There's a second problem related to that, which as news conglomerates have replaced reporters from individual papers and broadcasters and broadcasters with centralized bureaus that provide coverage for all the media outlets, an important link in the process of public policy formulation and debate has been broken. With no reporters from their own organizations and communities in Ottawa, news media across the country in various cities no longer cover or even mention their local members of parliament. Public policy options, debates, or decisions are never translated to the local level because there's no journalists from those communities reporting in Ottawa, and centralized groups don't do it. Centralized distributors of news. But not surprising that almost half of Canadians, more than 40% who didn't bother to vote in the last election, think the federal government's largely irrelevant in their lives. The changes in the media are really to blame for that. At the same time, politicians in Ottawa from all parties no longer face questions from local media located in their Ottawa bureaus. So MPs get a less direct sense of what issues are important in their own communities that they can play into the public policy debate or public policy formulation. This has happened in Ottawa, but as I said, it's replicated and it's even worse in provincial capitals. In the past, if the media decided something wasn't important enough to cover, readers, listeners, and viewers had recourse, but not anymore. The result is anyone interested in public policy has moved beyond the mainstream media, thanks to the rise of new technologies that allow for communication and debate completely independent of media, who used to be the gatekeepers for all this by deciding what people needed to know and when they needed to know it. That's a fundamental change that's taken place not just in public policy, but across a much broader spectrum of information of all sorts, thanks to digitization and the Internet. In turn, it is undermining the mainstream media status and influence, not to mention its audiences, much more substantially and substantively than the rich's impact on advertising. And as a final comment, as an example, just look at the successful campaigns that have operated to prevent changes to copyright legislation, organized among interested public and groups, applying pressure to politicians, almost completely independent of the media. The issue is hardly covered at all in the media. And that, I think, is going to become much more common in the future. Just like the media, politicians and bureaucrats have been gatekeepers too. They've controlled discussion, choices, and formulation of public policy through a variety of measures, including willful and deliberate daily violation of both the spirit and letter of the Act and Mission legislation. There are a few signs at the moment in Canada that some of this is changing, just the way it's changed for the media, and more signs in the United States. The digital and technological forces that have successfully undermined mainstream media's gatekeeper role are turning their attention to public policy. The result for the public policy gatekeeper, I think, will be the same as it was for the media. Thank you.
Well, having worked for a prime minister, I can attest that there's no greater honor than working for one, and no more demanding task than working in the laundromat building where you don't have a life. You work 18 hours a day, you're connected to your phone, your BlackBerry, and all the other gadgets that keep you connected to the boss. And when you leave, the phone doesn't ring as much anymore, but at least you get your life back. And that's what I can say with my good friend Sandra Buckler.
Thank you, Ian. This forum on other media and public opinion matter to public policy is certainly for me an interesting topic to explore, and I just want to thank Antonia for thinking of me for this panel. A few things. First, I've worked in the field of communication for what seems like an eternity, and I love it. People have hired me to help them communicate to the public through the media in good times and in bad. Some of the things I do is crafting a message that cuts through the clutter, designing media campaigns that I hope at least last for more than one day, and helping people manage their issues in times of crisis, find out what we know, what we don't know, how we take the issues seriously, and communicate often to provide reassurance. I've always been on the side of preparing people to talk to media, the candidates, CEOs, VPs, friends, and family. And these people, and people that do what I do, well, we're called handlers. And yeah, there's other names that we could be called, but I don't like them, so I'm not going to use them. People who do what I do understand the pressures on media, 24-hour news cycle, timelines, editors breathing down their throats, filing numerous stories for print, they have online editions, blogs, now they Twitter, and all this stuff takes up their time. So in good times, if you want to get their attention, you have to be creative. And in bad times, like crises, you have to be ready. So when I provide communications advice or media training, or when I manage the communications for Prime Minister Harper, I make sure I stress to every caucus member, every cabinet minister, every senator, and every party member, that if you're going to talk to media, you have to be ready. During my time as Director of Communications, I always was quite blunt on what I did and what I didn't do. And I didn't do policy, but I sure had to ask a lot of questions so I understood what the policy was so we could communicate it. I saw up close and personal the machinery of government, what worked and how public policy was developed, how the advice in the pre-council was received, how our political agenda was managed, and how public opinion and the media get into the mix. I believe that public opinion and the media matter when it comes to public policy, and when I asked a few reporters if they mattered, some said yes, and some just weren't sure. As a professional, I understand that, but as a politician or as a political person, public opinion matters a lot to me and a lot of my friends. And where do people get information? Chris has described a whole bunch of places, and people Google a lot. They also have the water chat by the water fountain, but they also get a lot of stuff from the media. So I wanted to talk about three issues to kind of illustrate my point. I want to talk about food and product safety. I'd like to touch a little bit about Afghanistan. I'd like to talk about the economy. And one was a crisis that wasn't made in Canada. One was a policy that was inherited, and one evolving. First, to food and product safety. As we all know, it started with an evening news story from China about toys and food. There was a lot of media generated from it, and people read those stories, and they became aware of the issue. Then the public opinion polls hit. And no surprise, people wanted to make sure that their food was safe and their toys that their children played with weren't going to hurt them. The government of Canada watched and listened and understood that this was a serious problem. And this issue of food and privacy made it into the speech from the throne, and then it followed with legislation. Now, to be truthful, the government did hit a setback, notably foods and the outbreak of listeriosis, and of course the tragic loss of life. Then there were those regrettable comments by the Minister of Agriculture, and while he did apologize very quickly, it was damaging. But the legislation continues, and the impact of the media and of public opinion was dramatic on this issue. Turning to Afghanistan, we begin by saying this is a completely complex file to communicate. As you will recall, there was no discourse when our troops were deployed to Afghanistan back in 2001. When Stephen Harper became Prime Minister, we noticed a massive information gap, and we tried to take many steps to inform the public about this very important mission, and it was hard. The first thing we did, the minister went to Afghanistan, and we took media with us and gave a major address to our troops at Kandahar Air Force Base. But then we discovered that the gap was even bigger than we imagined. Canadians didn't know why we were there. They didn't know it was a UN-mandated NATO legend. They didn't know how many troops we actually had on the ground, and I could go on. We also had the new problem that was difficult to communicate, and that other NATO countries didn't want to man up and send more people to Afghanistan. And what was happening? Canada was doing all the heavy lifting. And worse, we were losing our brave men in uniform. Added to that gap, you have the rhetoric from the NDP. You have other left-of-center groups demanding that we leave Afghanistan. There was division in the Liberal Party, and there was sudden withdrawal of the support from the Bloc Québécois. But still, we pushed forward to inform Canadians. Websites were launched. Ministers gave speeches. The Prime Minister went again to Afghanistan. President Karzai came to Canada and gave a big speech to Parliament. And, we had numerous technical briefings for the media, and we even broke a rule, and we put somebody on record every time. Sometimes these briefings weren't well attended. Sometimes they were. And then we launched a family panel. So why did we do all this? Well, because we wanted to make sure the public knew what we were doing over in Afghanistan. We wanted to make sure that they were informed because their opinions mattered. And so while I was at the Prime Minister's office and I left in July 1, 2008, public opinion was around 50 to 51%, and it had been steady for 3 years, at least I was there. And I think the public is better informed now. And the media, well, their coverage has been vast. Some good, and a couple not so good. And I recognize the fact that the development side of the story is hard to tell, it's hard to sell, and it's hard to report. Because it takes a long time to build a school in Afghanistan. It takes a long time to provide the encouragement to women to start their own business. And it takes an awful long time to encourage little girls it's okay to go back to school. But we pushed on because we believe Canadians deserve to know. And finally, my comments wouldn't be complete without a little quick snapshot about the economy. There's lots of people benefiting from this crisis because they seek out serious efforts and they covered the issue seriously. But I remember when it first raised its head. We were at a PEI, Prince Edward Island, for a caucus meeting, and it was the summer of 2007. And the Prime Minister gave a big news conference, as known to do, and it lasted probably 50 to 60 minutes. And there was only one reporter from Bloomberg who asked a question about the credit crunch. Because there was another issue that everybody wanted to talk about that day, but the Prime Minister was piqued by this reporter. And I asked him later why he asked this question then, because I wanted to maybe use this for this panel. And he said because the issue was important to his readers, and he wanted to know what the Prime Minister felt. So to me, Bloomberg represents a new kind of media organization, one that has a focused, educated readership that's interested in our news. Bloomberg was, again, the first reporter to ask or to begin the tremor of credit crunch for its people. So is maybe why mainstream media are having trouble finding readers or viewers because their audience is segmented? Something we can probably discuss, and I'm sure you'll ask us questions on us. And as Chris talked about, there's massive restructuring going on in Canadian media, and I don't know what it can look like when it's all said and done. But I do know that yesterday President Obama held his first online town hall meeting. And yeah, only 67,000 people tuned in, but 9,000 Americans sent in questions. And so to me, this should be something that mass media should notice, that people are looking for opportunities to go over them, to talk to people, because they want to get the straight goods out without maybe filter, without maybe commentary. And I know the media get mad when we devise campaigns around them, but we're always looking for new and important ways to reach people. And I think, frankly, it's important. And I would just close by saying that I know a lot of people have hired me to help them. And if mass media and the public opinion didn't matter, then I would be unemployed, and I'm not. So that would be my comment. Thank you.
Speaking of President Obama, he had a White House summit with the bankers, bank CEOs from Wall Street today, and at noon the Dow was down 200 points. I don't know what that tells us. But Nick Ness is one of these, as we said in the previous introduction, leading pollsters in the 2006 election. In his last poll, he famously called all four parties within one-tenth of one percentage point of the actual outcome, and he called that the perfect score. It certainly was. In poll, when it works for us at Policy Options, we ask him not to do voting intention normally, but attitudinals, which we think gives us a true picture of public opinion. Drilling down, we call it drilling down deeper. And interestingly, when we ran before the budget, we found that only 11% of Ontarians are in favor of bailouts of the auto industry. And guess where the auto industry is located? So you can get some idea of the difficulty of selling the kind of message that Mr. Flaherty was talking about last night when you're talking about helping the Detroit 3. Nick is going to give his thoughts on the vision now.
Great. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. So thank you, McGill. Usually I have to explain and analyze the views of others. So today we're going to lift the veil. I'm going to tell you what I really think about what's going on. I'm going to share some personal observations, and I'm going to challenge you. I'm going to put things on the table. I might say things that are controversial, but they're based on things that I'm concerned about. As a researcher, as someone that's interested in good public policy, and even as a Canadian, there are a lot of things going on in regards to the media, public opinion, and what I'm going to parse separately, mass opinion, that I find very disturbing and not a positive addition to, I'll say, the public policy process. And so it'll be important that I'm going to parse out public opinion, which in my world reflects what's actually going on, with what I call mass opinion. Mass opinion is what we see on the web. It's basically a lot of voices out there, unregulated, unfiltered, unverified, and unchecked. And what I want to do today is talk about the interrelation between the media, mass opinion, and public opinion. And basically my thesis is that, you know, good politics does not necessarily make good public policy. So really when we're looking at what's going on out there, there's a significant, in my opinion, you're going to hear me say it a lot, in my opinion, power shift that's going on. The media are weakened, and mass opinion is strengthened. And this particular time of transition, in my opinion, is very dangerous, and it's very dangerous from the point of view of a public policy perspective. And, you know, we tend to look at what's going on in the media right now and, you know, papers closing and money being lost and the seemingly economically unviable aspect of what's going on in the media. But the reality is that's a symptom. That's actually, yes, that's happening, but that is a symptom of a larger problem, and it has to do with this what I'll call shift in power to mass opinion. You know, in the past, really, when you think about it, the media had greater barriers to entry in regards to competition. It was the printing press, right? It was knowledge and the ability to access information. And that basically gave them an inherent advantage. That also gave them significant responsibility in regards to public discourse. But what we see now is a transformation, and I don't say that a positive or a negative transformation, I just say it's a transformation where anyone with a computer and a keyboard with internet access can basically self-style themselves as a pundit, self-style themselves as an analyst, put opinions out there, purported facts, and basically build a community or following to perpetuate those views, whether they're accurate or not. And I think the fundamental problem is that when people read something on the web, they're still kind of reading with the same kind of attitude that we read newspapers 20 years ago. We read the newspaper, and it must be true because it's written there. And I think in this transitional phase, people still are reading the web and looking at things on the web with the same attitude that they used to consume information in what I'll say the former mass media. And the problem is that the web is open to manipulation by political players. I see it happen all the time. I'm sure you see it. It's open to unchecked and unverified information that basically are complete falsities. And what it does is perpetuates a fundamental disconnect with what I think is reality in regards to what's actually going on. You know, the challenge is that it's so compelling. We see 20,000 comments on something or 50,000 people reading something or you know, just any kind of issue that kind of galvanizes people. It's very compelling for politicians and for civil servants. And, you know, think of it this way. You know, think of a civil servant sitting across the table from a legislator who's reading laws, polls, who's on the Internet doing his or her own policy research. You know, if it's akin to, you know, people who, you know, are ill and they go on the Internet, self-diagnose themselves, and they go to the doctor to tell the doctor what's actually wrong. And this is a fundamental problem and a risk that we're dealing with right now. And, you know, to shift gears in regards to research and, well, say, true public opinion research, good public opinion research adds to the public dialogue and it accurately captures what's going on. But there's a lot of public opinion research that is not good. Divisive research. You know, we were talking about Afghanistan. You know, we can ask whether people are in favor or opposed to Afghanistan, but thoughtful research asks people what they think about our objectives in Afghanistan. Are they achievable? Are they the right objectives? Do we have enough resources to achieve those objectives? That informs us much better than what I'll say the headline of 51% opposed or in favor, 49% with an opposite opinion. And then there's what I'll call the Aladdin's lamp research, right? Make a wish. Would you like to be wealthier? Yes. Would you like to seek? Yes. The challenge with that type of research is that it does not present the trade-offs. And from a public policy perspective, good research presents trade-offs. Because it's not as simple as saying, would you like a 1% cut in GST? What you have to do is contextualize. Would you like a 1% cut in GST? And if that meant that the federal government could not transfer as much funds, or it affected health care, what do you think? Or if it affected education, or what would you do with that? And I think one of the problems is that the trade-offs aren't really presented and explored. And I think, finally, there's a real lack of contextualization out there in regards to what's going on, and a very short-term view. You know, in regards to, we have problems with the media, we have problems in regards to what I'll say reality because of mass opinion. We have businesses that 30 years ago were engaged in public policy dialogue in Canada because they knew it was important. Now, they're focused on shareholder value. I think with the downturn in the economy, there's going to be a big change. I think business leaders, whether we like them or not, are realized that they actually have an inherent stake in public policy. I think they're going to come back to the table. There's another problem in regards to the commoditization of, and this is just my personal opinion, the commoditization of what I'll say senior civil service. You know, we talked about, you know, is it good that a deputy minister is only head of a ministry for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years? What's wrong with being a deputy minister for 10 years in agriculture in order to shape a long-term plan? And another thing that I'm very concerned about is the weakening link between academia and policymakers in Ottawa. You know, when I was undergrad at Queen's, I had the honor of learning from Ronald Watts, and I don't know if any of you know Ronald Watts. He was a very distinguished professor. And I remember there'd be classes where he'd say, I won't be here next class because I'm going to Ottawa. This is 1980 in the Mulroney years. I'm going to Ottawa because there are discussions about the Constitution and the future of the country where academics were directly plugged in, their shoulders tapped. But we're not seeing that as much now. So basically, to kind of wrap up, I think we should be asking, can the media and public opinion matter? But it's going to need a new environment. Legislators need to shift from the short term, what do the polls tell us today, to what is the trend in the polls. And the media are going to need to renew. I think in this transition phase, eventually things are going to work itself out because people are going to realize what the web is, and that will be a perfect opportunity for the media to make itself and to reengage. And finally, we're going to need pollsters who focus on finding commonalities of opinion and solutions that explore trade-offs, real trade-offs, and are founded on a long-term view. So that's it for me. I know we're going to chat later, so that's it. Thank you.
One of the great things about Alain Bertholomew in La Presse is that he has a great flair for asking questions that are on people's mind and informing people, readers, on the issues they want to be informed about. Today, for example, he was asking, raising the issue of whether the Casey DePoe should get involved in a bid from the Montreal Canadiens. Now, there's a serious public policy issue for you.
Thank you. So I'll try to answer the question that was asked, which is, do media matter? I think they do. Of course, you'll say I'm a journalist, so I believe in my business, but they do matter, but not for the good reasons, and the process is not always healthy. So I say, yes, the media matter, and I'm not always proud of that. Because we are in a context where politicians deal with short-term issues, are reactive, and tend to insist on politics instead of policies. And in this context, media do matter. But I'm trying to define media in a very broad sense, not only news media, but the whole thing. Media is also YouTube. It's comic shows. It's sitcoms, talk shows, because this is where people get their information, but also where they get a kind of feel on what they think is reality. It's this whole media environment that defines how politicians should look, how they should talk, what is right and what is wrong. So news media are only a part of this mediatic environment, and I think that as news media we have been influenced by sitcoms and the whole thing. That's one thing. And the other one is when you talk about public opinion, I think that it's a more complex than we usually say, and it's, you have many levels of public opinion. And you have inside public opinion, there are deep realities like beliefs, values, a sense of history of money, but you'll also have epidemic reactions. And when we talk of the influence of media on public opinion, we're talking about those reactive levels of what is public opinion. And I think that the link between media and the public opinion is a two-way thing. We sometimes reflect what public opinion is. In some issues like health, for example, I think that media describe exactly what are the feelings and the views of Canadians. When in some cases, we shape what is public opinion. And not in every it works only in very specific areas. I know because I tried as an editorialist to shape opinion. It doesn't work. You cannot transform a Parti Québécois, a militant, into a fidelist. It doesn't work. You don't really change the mind of people, but you can play, you can reinforce or you can accelerate trends that are already present. This is what we do. We are accelerators, which is not always healthy. That's one thing. The other place where we do play the role is that media are a kind of tribunal. It's the first place where politicians and policy makers test their ideas, their programs. And so we can kill a good one, can kill politicians with a few. In a few minutes, we can decide that something is wrong, and if it starts on the wrong foot, we know that media can derail the whole process. So we have a huge responsibility, and the thing I'm afraid of is that we don't have the level of responsibility or even of consciousness of our importance to play this role. And the image that I always, I used it before, is like, in some ways, media look like children with the bazookas. And there are many reasons for that, because there are no mechanism to evaluate what we're doing. Who said that when it was written in a newspaper, it must be right? It was not true, even 20 years ago. And so, not always true, sometimes it was. And so there's no mechanism to evaluate what we're doing. There are no mechanisms to counterbalance the influence of the media when it's a wrong one. And inside the media, there's no awareness of this, the importance of what we can do. Of course, we feel that we can have an impact on some issues, but basically, media think that they are not placed, that they are exterior to the events, that they are objective, that they are outside debates, when basically we are players and we contribute to shape events. And so, and this is a process which is getting stronger and stronger because of the place of the mediatic reality is something that media tend not to analyze, not to acknowledge. So, yeah, so I think that there's a problem. And sometimes I'm not proud of being a journalist. Can I say that? And I think that there are dangers and that they will probably become worse and worse because the social media is weaker. So we'll tend to overreact, to assert our importance in society. And this also is not a healthy trend. Thank you.
Well, speaking of a crisis of public policy, we have a crisis in policy and profit in the media going on right now. It's a combination of a cyclical downturn that's brutal and sector change that is very transformational. It was Bill Gates who famously said that everything would end up on computers one day, and here we are. More people watched President Obama's inauguration on the Internet than watched it on television. They were at their desks. It was in the middle of the day. They just watched it on their desks rather than turning on CNN. They watched it on CNN.com. Anecdotally, last year I was having a drink at Highs in Ottawa with the senior manager of the CTV newsroom, which is the working set you see behind Lloyd Robertson. That's a real newsroom. And she was saying they were taking all TVs off people's desks because they didn't need them anymore. They could watch their own newscasts and others online. I said, what does this tell you about the future of television? And she said, yeah, no kidding. Just in terms of profit and loss, CTV announced that they are going to take a $100 million loss this year. It's been a cash cow for decades. And that they've written down $1.7 billion of their businesses. They've written down 75% of the value of the business. The CBC laid off 800 employees yesterday, which is about 8% of their workforce. Canwest is penny stock. Any one of its metro papers, is worth, including the Gazette, is worth about twice as much as the holding company today, which the last time I looked at it, and God knows I bought some of it, was at about 40 cents. Sun Media has laid off 600 employees across the country. That's 25% of their system. And in the U.S., to give you just one example, in Seattle, one of the most urbane and highly literate and educated risk markets in America, home to Microsoft and Wahoo and Starbucks and Boeing, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer is going out of business. The L.A. Times is on the edge, and so is the Chicago Tribune, and the New York Times, lost $200 million last year, while record number of people were visiting their website. And as Chris could maybe speak to this, you know, the New York Times is more popular than it's ever been, but nobody's buying the paper. And if you're not buying the paper, then we're all just content providers, but content providers without jobs. Believe me, in our business, this issue has everyone's attention. And if you don't have viable news media, you don't have anyone to cover what's going on in public policy. So setting the table for that second round of discussions among our panelists, and we'll throw it to you for the clinic. Chris, you want to take that first?
Sure. Let me offer a couple of quick thoughts. Yes, this is a time of difficulty. If as much of the one of the curious things is that the media had it seems to have discovered it about 3 weeks ago. It's been going on for quite a while, but they haven't really, I don't think, paid a lot of attention to it. I would, yes, there are problems in some aspects of the media at the moment. We have an industry that's owned by very few people that accumulated a huge amount of debt in order to acquire the conglomerates that they've acquired. And if the argument is that the model that says you accumulate huge amounts of debt to buy everything you can, well, you cut back what you're doing in your product and reduce the quality of your product, and you assume that the economy goes on forever in good times and you're going to get a 20 or 25% rate of return. If that's your model, the model's broken. That's true. But that's not necessarily a very good long-term model. At the same time, we're not hearing much about a lot of the other interesting things that are going on in the media at the moment. It's never been cheaper to buy equipment, to use any equipment. Equipment's never been lighter, it's never been easier to get around anywhere, it's never been easier, cheaper to port from anywhere. It's true, a lot of the existing organizations are in trouble, but General Motors and Chrysler. And maybe what we're looking at is a big change that, on one hand, the media hasn't come to grips with very well, in part because not very many news organizations in Canada have figured what's going on the Internet yet, partly because all they're trying to use the Internet for is to use it as a distribution for something they're producing somewhere else already, rather than looking at the fact you need to be doing different things and producing it differently. It doesn't mean you can make money at the moment, but a lot of what the industry... You need to remember that what the television industry is talking about is a slice of a big pie, and some other aspects of their pie, like specialty channels and some of the other areas, are doing very well. Government in this country over the last 20 years has assumed that conglomerate and concentration of ownership of the media is a thing. One of the arguments, yes, you could make for conglomerate ownership is that if you have a conglomerate, parts of your conglomerate do well, other parts don't necessarily do as well. The parts that aren't doing as well are supported by the parts that are, until you figure out how to fix the other parts. The other thing I would say about a lot of the conversation at the moment is I don't think it's all doom and gloom. It sounds a lot like the record industry before iTunes came along.
Hey. Well, I'm still a bit disturbed and concerned, but... Because, you know, I think of the responsibility that the media have. Right? When, you know, to my point about mass opinion and public opinion, if the media doesn't take its responsibility, maybe that's why it's not making money. Maybe that it doesn't have eyeballs, because maybe it's lost a sense of what its real responsibility is in our society. And, you know, we listen to that, and he says, the media think they're not players. And, you know, I'd like to add a couple things to the list. So the media think they're not players. Politicians are trained SEALs. No one leaves pollsters, and civil servants are not special. What does that mean about our current state of affairs? Well, what it means is people in this room have to take responsibility. You know, there's a very compelling story I was once told where the President of the United States was down in Cape Canaveral, and he was in the lobby, going to the lobby, and there was a gentleman there sweeping the floor, and he asked the gentleman, "What's your name? What do you do here?" And he said, "My name's John. My job is to send one to the moon." He didn't say I was a janitor. He didn't say it was somebody else's problem. It wasn't somebody else's responsibility. He took ownership. And I think, you know, the takeaway, you know, we have to hit a breaking point. You know, someone once said you have to bring people to the abyss, to look down into the pit before it can get a change. And I think the media has to change. I think Canadians have to become more engaged. Politicians have to change. Pollsters have to change, because it's not going to be pleasant. I don't think we're going to be very happy, and I think it'll really be a service to what we're trying to accomplish.
So they have two problems. But there are two big ones and so many small ones. I do think that newspapers, newsroom, are the main producers of news now. And we don't make money with it anymore. Because TV, radio, and still our news. And then the internet people when they're free on the internet get the same news. So we do produce news and no way to make money with it. And so it's a losing business proposition. And we have to find a way to find ways of making money on the internet if we want to survive. But that's one problem. The other one is that, like you said, the internet is not the same media. It's not, the reality is not described in the same way, and the process of getting information on the internet is not the same. And at the moment, even when you go through validated sites, the process of gathering information is less profound on the internet than in traditional newspapers or magazines. And so we still didn't find a way to convey news correctly. This new media findings, which are will be different, we cannot duplicate what we are doing in newspaper. We did not find a way of conveying the information on the internet. And I don't know how or if we will be able to do it, because if we find the trick, then the problem of newspapers and even TV shows is not so awful, because it means that the craft, and sometimes we do good things, this craft can be translated in other media, and we are new gatherers and new producers, whatever the media we use, but we did not find this way yet, the way to do it yet.
Can I just ask Sandra for her reflection on this media moment we're in now? Perhaps, Sandra, you could pick up on one of Nick's points about how with these new platforms, everybody's an instant pundit, and some of the problems that presents for mainstream media trying to cover public policy and politicians. For example, if one of your supporters puts up something offensive on his webpage or his Facebook page about same-sex marriage or something like that, that can become the drive-by shooting of the day on a prime minister's tour during an election, and you can lose 24 hours of positive news coverage just because someone way down the food chain did something stupid.
Well, and I guess to play on your point, if what we know in the paper is maybe not true, I wish people would accept that what we see on the internet is all maybe not true. And unfortunately, the more controversial or the more scandalous the blog is or the other snippet, can ruin people's lives. I've known MPs who have town hall meetings, and they know that somebody at the back of the room was videotaping them. And, you know, they make a couple of jokes, and then someone asks a serious question about the economy, and before you know it, the MP is portrayed as an uncaring, non-sympathetic guy who's unconnected to his community. So I tell people that in this new environment, you're always on. You actually can't make any off-color jokes. You actually can't be inventive. You can't be on a conference call and make a really bad joke about somebody not being well because they've eaten food that's not very good, because you will be held accountable for it because you're an elected official. And the elected officials I work with get mad and say, well, how come the media aren't held accountable for what they write when it's not true? And I said, well, you know, there's always apology on page A75, you know, 7 days later when they've written something that isn't true. But never give it a headline if it's not true next day. It's just not. And that's something that, you know, people like Alain and I always kind of fight over as somebody who's a hander to a reporter, because we always want to make sure that the person who was part of the interview who was destroyed, if it's wrong, they're put back whole. And it takes a long time. So the drive-by shootings are a problem. I worry about it. I have to be very careful. I don't see the National Press Gallery decreasing, but then I left in July. I still see a lot of people there, and maybe because there's too many of them, they don't, and there's not enough to cover, perhaps that's why there's some redundancy. But what I really worry about is the regional and local media, because for me, when the Parliament go home, that's where they should go. They should talk to their local reporters. They should get on their local radio stations. They should talk to their local TV guys. And I worry that if there is consolidation and there's places where there won't be that local connection, then the public will suffer. Citizens won't understand what their guy is doing in Ottawa. And I get the mass media and the Ottawa Press Gallery have a role, but that doesn't mean the regional guy and local guy also don't have an important role. So I always look at them as all very important. And I'd love to be able to help them in their current crisis, but unfortunately I'm going to have to have people communicate to them.
Final thought, Chris, and then we'll go to the Q&A.
Well, darn, I was going to take on Sandra on one thing. But only really quick. specifically on the Jerry Ritz case, I think that was a very good story, because if the minister is joking about an issue like that to his employees on the phone, I think that sends a message to his employees.
It was bad. And I think that take me out. It was bad. I wasn't there at the time, but I heard about it, and I thought it was awful. And I said it 1,000 times, you have to be on the job all the time. There's no room for error, especially when people die. No room for error.
But let me come back to something that Alain and Nick both talked about. One of the real advantages to the existing media process at the moment that no one is concentrating on at the moment is exactly what Nick has taught, is that the existing media, despite what Alain says, and he's largely right, the existing media has a level of ability, has a recognized process through which that's information, even though people disagree and sometimes say things are wrong. We understand how all that happens. They have what you would call in the business world a lot of goodwill. And they're not exploiting that goodwill necessarily as much as they can on the Internet to take advantage of the fact that I think a lot of people see that everything on the Internet is a lot of you don't know what's right and what's wrong. Well, I think the existing media have an opportunity there to take advantage of things they're taking advantage of. Part of the problem is the media is unbelievably conservative, I mean small c, and is unbelievably unwilling to innovate, unwilling to advance, unwilling to try and do different new things. I'll give you one really quick example. I'm talking in Canada. It's less so in the United States. I don't know if anyone saw things New York Times has done on the web. They did a great thing that I saw for Hillary Clinton's speech last year when she basically conceded that she finally lost the nomination. They started putting up speeches of all the leaders, and what they would put up on your web page is the video of the speech, the text of the speech, and then the subheadings of the speech. You could click at any point on the video, if you could click at any point on the subheading, it would take you to that point in the video, and you could also watch the speech too. Now, that's a really great use of the Internet, because if you're sitting and reading a newspaper story about Hillary Clinton saying, I've always supported Obama, and I look forward to him running for the leadership. I mean, how she said it, you don't get any sense of when you actually read on a page. But if you can watch it and see it, you have each opportunity. That was done in July or August. In October, we had a federal election. I guess it was October, late September, the leaders' debates were. I think lots of people would watch the leaders' debates on the website if you could actually put that all together like that. Well, where were the Canadian media? I mean, there's real opportunities to do things, and people have to take advantage of that and start trying different things and doing different things. It costs a bit of money, that's true, but there are different ways to present information, and I would argue that at the moment you may not be able to get people to pay money for it, but, you know, you might be able to. I read the New York Times on my iPhone every night, every day, and write other things. You might be able to get me to pay 25 cents a day to read the New York Times on my iPhone, and a business model might exist for the New York Times or for somebody else that if you take out all the capital costs of printing presses, newspapers, all that sort of thing, you can actually do something a lot cheaper than the existing structure. So what we may end up seeing is essentially the annihilation of the existing organizations, but we may see something else new actually emerge that is based on, that I hope would be sustainable on a different sort of financial structure.
Okay, we're going to send a search party out to try and find the good side of the Internet should be free.
Okay, our two MISC fellows have the microphone, so if anyone has a question... Yeah, rock and roll.
Just give us your name and your affiliation and try and keep your, no preambles if you don't mind, just questions, keep it to 3 seconds.
My name is Esther Lex and I'm a student at McGill. In light of the topic of the panel, media and the influence on public opinion, in my view, the problem of media conglomeration, which was touched on, becomes all the more stark and indeed problematic with fewer op-eds, fewer perspectives, that kind of thing. So I was wondering how you guys see sort of the future of the media in terms of conglomeration, what role the government might have to play in that.
Who wants to take that first? Nick, you want to have a...
I come from a group that is conglomerated. I participated in this process. And it depends. And what was said that one of the problems we suffer from now is that some of those groups were not healthy in financial terms, so you pay the price after a while. But there are other arguments in favor of concentration because you have tools, you have stability, you can exchange information depending where you do it. For example, in our group, you cannot exchange editorials. It's forbidden because you want voice and you don't want to reduce the number of voices. But do you send 7 different film critics in Cannes or 25 reporters in Vancouver when you can pool? So it depends where you do it, why you do it, how you do it. So, but I think you need some tools to control the process, and the other reason is that we have a weaker regional information than we had before, and most regional media are not sustainable. They cannot survive. So if they're not part of the group, you won't have any regional information anymore. So you have to balance all that. It's not perfect, but if you look at what's in other countries, and the other thing is, if you talk, the medias are more, it's an open world. And so you cannot just say, well, newspapers are concentrated because we're not, we're only now a little part of the game. Radio is a little part of the game, of magazines. You cannot talk about media without talking about McLean's. And if we're wrong in newspapers, you have magazines, then you have the internet, and you have so many TV stations. And this is this old world that creates the balance. And so, and media is that because our power, our influence is not as strong as before. So you have to look at the whole picture of the media to see if there's a problem, if there's not, with concentration.
I'd add a couple of things to that and say, I think one of the problems with concentration, well, agreeing with Alan on some benefits, I think some of the problems we've seen is in an attempt largely to maintain profit margins, what we've seen is a degree of standardization across property all across the country so that a lot of the local individuality of the Calgary Herald or the Ottawa Citizen or the Montreal Gazette has been eliminated in more of a homogenized product. And I think that's cost, and that's also true on television in terms of local television stations. I think that's cost, and it cost the media both readers and a degree of public support and public involvement at the same time. I think we also, what I think the new media world will tell us is that huge rates of return are not going to happen anymore in the future. Newspapers literally get 20, 25, 30% rate of return. Business would be really happy with 4 or 5 or 6. I think we're heading into an environment because of all the competition that Alan's talking about where whoever owns media outlets is going to have to survive with a much smaller profit margin than they have for, which may ultimately argue for a reversion to private ownership rather than public ownership if the market is not prepared to accept the smaller rate of return. So we could end up, and that I think might not be a bad thing. We ended up back in a world where more media properties were owned by people who always used to own media properties, which is because they wanted a platform to express their points of view. And as long as we understand what their points of view are, it can be kind of an interesting environment sometimes. So I think all those things are kind of in flux at the moment. But it is a mixed thing with not all positive and negative.
There was a moment just before the tech bubble burst in 2000 where there was a craze called convergence, where a lot of people overpaid to become conglomerates, where Bell, for example, paid $2.5 billion to acquire CTV, which was a bunch of local stations, where the Aspers may well have overpaid with Conrad Black to buy what were then Southern newspapers. And that have led to some of the balance sheet problems that some of these companies, not all of them, have today. Longer term, in Quebec, on the French side, only two families, the Peladeaux and the Demarest, control 100% of the French language newspaper circulation in this province. One of them owns the most popular TV network, the Peladeaux. But Quebecor, if you look at it from a business buy, is a good convergence model. And if it buys the Montreal Canadiens, it'll be an even better one because it has a lot of platforms that need or that can profit from that kind of a franchise. And they already have on the entertainment side on Sunday nights with Starmania, for example. Nick?
Well, you know, my interest is trying to grapple with what this means for the future. Like, the path that we're on right now is one of what I'll call mass customization. Right? If you create your own portal, you customize news on your site depending on what news sources that you want. We're moving towards mass customization for TV, which is why the networks are squeezed. We'll be able to, you know, pick the news and situation comedies and everything else that we want to watch on TV. And, you know, it even extends to music. You know, I think last night, Ian, we were chatting, and he was saying, you know, his dog Gracie, you know, she has an iPod. She listens to it all the time. And Ian was saying, geez, I wonder what she's, you know, what kind of music that she's listening to. The reality is, and that maybe this is one of the things we should think about, what is the role of media in nation building, not just a responsibility? And that when we get into a fragmented, customized, personalized world, what are the things that bind us? Now, we know from history that the media had a significant role, not just in educating Canadians or citizens, but they played a significant role in nation building, bringing people together, letting people understand people from other points of views. So, you know, we talk about what's happening today, and, you know, it's really terrible that, you know, the media's in trouble. I'm more worried about the path that we might be going on, and we should be thinking about what does that mean for society? What does that mean for nation building and voices that can help Canadians have the society that we want to have? That's what kind of concerns me.
Manuel, someone in the back.
And I'm the executive director of an organization called Apathy is Boring. Mm-hmm. And what we do is try to engage young people in the democratic process in art and technology. I get most of my news from Twitter right now, so I'll preface what I'm going to say with that. But just to follow up, actually, on what you just mentioned in terms of nation building, there's a huge disconnect between young people and traditional media. There's a huge disconnect between young people and public policy. And so, you know, I would argue that maybe what needs to happen is we need to find some sort of leadership in terms of how to take that mass opinion and turn it into valuable collaboration and conversation. So I guess my question is, how would you or perhaps other panelists suggest that we take the huge amount of information and comments that are happening online and actually make that into public policy, and who should be the one who's taking the leadership role in terms of making that happen?
Who wants to take that?
I could just start off because I'm a partisan. I've been a partisan since I was a little girl because my dad was a big Tory and my mom was a general liberal. And so I grew up in a house where your opinion really mattered, and you really couldn't come and have supper, bring any friends to supper, unless they had an opinion too, because it was a big discussion at the table. What I struggle with is, you know, I'm not going to be on my age, but I'm getting up there. And what I don't see behind me is a lot of people who are involved in student union or got involved in political parties. There's no real youth wing now, the conservatives. I can't speak to the other parties because I don't know. But it makes me a little sad because, you know, okay, when I was younger, I was pretty right-wing, but I had a lot of friends and did a lot of neat stuff together, and it was all social, some politics. But we grew up together, and it's a network, and we all stay in touch together now, so we have our own little kind of Twitter group. And it makes me a little depressed, and students of today don't feel connected to politicians. They don't feel that they have a voice. They don't feel that Stephen Harper or Michael Ignatieff care about them or listen because they're not going to a fundraiser or they're not, you know, going to, you know, the Arctic where the PM's issue with it right now. So for me as a woman, as a former youth in the party, I want to engage people. Like I love sitting down and talking to young people about why they feel they don't have a say. I think it's important that they have a voice, and I struggle with what that voice is. But I'd like to see younger people run for office. I'd like to see younger people get out there and talk about their views. And I think, you know, regardless of what happens with the media, there's always going to be a microphone, and there is always going to be someone listening. I don't know what it's like. I'm happy with online stuff. I'm happy with electronic stuff. But I think people need to talk more and not be afraid to share their views. So I don't know. I don't have a big answer, but I know that think about it, at least in Ottawa and at least in my group, and maybe stay tuned. We'll see what we come up with.
Because Nick talked about customization, fragmentation, but there's also another ending, which is interaction, and which is probably the strong point of the internet and all those platforms. And this is something that he didn't give and that newspapers didn't accept across the letters to the ear. So this is a powerful tool, but it's a dangerous one, curiously. We can't say that interaction is wonderful, but when you deal with the internet, we see it in newspapers with all the sites, you know exactly what people are reading every second. And so it can lead you to transform your content to get more readers, and usually you go down. And the topics that are the most popular on the internet are not the most noble ones. It's a rule. I wrote once, I have columns, and one of them, my biggest hit on the internet, was about the pork industry in Quebec. And my title was, I didn't think about it, it was Une histoire de cochon. And it was a hit because a lot of readers thought that it wasn't about something else. So yes, and the adventure, if you use the internet, that if you don't find ways to use this powerful tool of interaction, but build on it and not influence it, but foster in some ways, it can be useless and can be very vain. And this is something I don't know how to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not nearly as pessimistic. I mean, I'm probably older than Sander, and certainly in the era when I grew up, Canadians and young Canadians were very inward-looking. We were very much afraid of what we told about domination from the United States, about our culture being in peril, our life being in peril, and everything else. The students I meet, and I'm fortunate enough to have the opportunity to teach, are an unbelievable group of people who travel all over the world, who work all over the world, who have interests all over the world. What they're not interested in is what's going on in Canada. That's true. And I mean, maybe I might turn that around and say, what is it exactly that's gone on in Canada in the last 4 years or 5 years that you think they should be interested in? Because they're interested in a lot of stuff that goes on in Parliament and stuff that gets debated. It's hard for them to relate to their lives. I mean, the most interesting thing to them is probably copyright protection.
Briefly, Nick?
Yes. You know, I was doing a talk at UO, and I showed a bunch of headlines. One of them was, tired government needs to be booted out, misuse of government funds, prime minister scandal. And I remember asking the executives at the time when they thought those headlines came from, and they were actually from the 1870s. And at that time, that's when MacDonald lost that one election, and they talked about reform and engaging voters. And if that particular little government introduced the secret ballot, if we introduced the secret ballot, they created the Auditor General, there are a whole bunch of initiatives. And the difference in the voter turnout between the election that they won and the election afterwards that they lost was 1%. because they thought if we just had a secret ballot, more Canadians would come out. I don't know what the answer is, and I think we do have to deal with apathy, but I think we have to take more of a long-term view that the problems that we're facing today, they're not new. That doesn't mean we shouldn't deal with them, but take the long term.
I don't know about Twitter. I'm still working on Facebook. And I can tell you that in terms of transformational change in ours, the first campaign I covered was the 1974 Trudeau-Sandfield campaign, famous which in price controls election. And I went on the road that year with a manual typewriter, a Smith-Rona Marchant. You might have your parents have one in their basement, and which weighed 30 pounds, and a 30-pound fax machine. A cylindrical tube that weighed one copy at 6 minutes a page. And today I can write my column on my BlackBerry Pearl with two fingers and push a button, and it's at the Gazette or the National Post. And I guess what I'm saying is we've always been able to cope with these changes, and ultimately we welcome them. But when you're in the middle of them, it's sometimes a bit uncomfortable. Tony, I think you wanted the last question.
A different question to different people on the panel. Chris, I'd like to ask you, as a matter of journalism, are you teaching your students enough that they'll be prepared to be able to contribute to the public policy making process? Do you feel that in training journalism students and sending them up there, as Alain says, without much more than a bazooka in their hands, that they're going to do the right thing? And how could you tell us that? I'd also like to ask Nick and Alain, when they, in Alain's case, write their columns or produce the numbers, how do you think politicians and public servants are reading you? So when you write your column or when you produce your public opinion and try to interpret those polls, what do you think you're actually doing in terms of public policymaking process? Or do you think it at all? And Sandra, I want you to comment whether that's really what politicians and policymakers are, what they're seeing when people like Alain write their column and when people like Nick produce their numbers.
And because Antonia's the host here, she gets more questions rather than
I go first?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, of the 100 or so students who graduated of the Bachelor of Journalism program, maybe you're only about 20 want to be journalists. Most of them go off to do as many go to communications or public relations, about 5 to 10 go to law school, about 5 to 15 go graduate studies, whatever their major minor. Are we training enough? Yes and no. We're not training them enough because there's no replacement for real-world experience for being out there and actually doing stuff. What I think we are training them to do is to have context in what they're reporting and what they're talking to people about and doing research, and try to put perspective and times in their reporting and in their coverage, and to try to be skeptical of everything here, to realize that everyone who's talking to you has an agenda and they're not your friends. And your job is to put that all in an appropriate context and try and sort out what's right and wrong and do the research that gives you the perspective you need, and to keep on talking to different people all the time to find different views and see how they're reflected. It works well with some people, it works less well with
I'm generally not very popular with politicians because they usually don't like what I say, and I tell them, I'm just putting a mirror on you. This is what you are, and this is what people think. When we're working on research, like when we're partnering with Ian at Policy Options, we sit down and, you know, we ask the same questions when we're trying to figure out what to do. We say, how can we tell people something that they don't know? How can we shed some new light, right? How can we add to the dialogue? How can we nurture more thoughtful opinion on this? How can we get people to focus on a particular issue? So there's that in regards to what I'll say, putting a light on something in a little more thoughtful fashion. But I also see at least the role of polling as a check. Politicians cannot get up and say whatever they want to say. The thing is that polling gives voice to Canadians, right? You know, from a consumer perspective, when you ride the bus in the morning, it's because the Transit Authority Montreal has listened to transit riders on where the bus should be, and just all those touch points through your whole day. And the same thing with public policy. It gives voice to Canadians, and, you know, woe to a government that ignores. I know, Ian, are you disagreeing with me, Ian? So, it's difficult for a government to consistently ignore public opinion if it wants to be elected.
There, when you write an editorial or a column, there are different strategies. You can write, when you write, you can think about a politician you want to talk to them with, or public servants, and then you craft your column in a very specific way to be convincing to people who are knowledgeable. And so, in some ways, you're trying to show that you're right when they are, or that you have some points or ideas that can be useful for them. That's one way of doing things. The other way is to write for readers. And it's a very different process, because your strength doesn't come from the fact that you write or not, but the fact that you will be popular or not with readers. And so it's a very indirect process where wrong and be efficient because people believe you. And politicians will follow what you're writing, not because it's right, but because 100 or 200,000 people read it and believe that right. So it's a, you have two, but you can so also try to convince people and be very careful about your saying and knowing that if you are efficient in this kind of effort, then you'll have a much power, a full swing than when you write directly to politicians. As the UN, for example, how do you see décrochage in English? We have a very high drop rate in Quebec. Do you write to deputy ministers about the issue, or do you try to convince readers? That's a very, it's a drop. And if you convince both, then you'll have a kind of feedback that will go back to politicians. So it's two ways of doing the same thing, and depending on the case, I work on different levels.
So I would say that, politicians read what's written. They do pay attention to editorial pages a little more because the news, you know, it is every day, and everybody knows that, well, when they read headlines, they look at those and freak out. If it's bad or get happy if it's good, they read a couple of paragraphs and then move on. So politicians generally do pay more attention to our pages because, you know, that's a thoughtful kind of representation of what's happening. And if they don't read them themselves, then they have people like you who read them and tell them what's in the press, which is all fun because I like to read. There are some politicians who are obsessed with every piece of meat possible, and I'm not sure that's helpful either. So it's good to kind of, you know, shave off a little bit and read the ones that really matter. As for polling, because I'm sitting right next to Nick, I'm just mindful of my own personal safety, so I'll just do this. The government did not ignore Paul Pena, Nick. They don't hear it. But they're more sophisticated now because they had a lot of time to come to grips with public opinion polls. So politicians will generally think it's a snapshot. They're more interested in trends. Is the prime minister more popular today than yesterday? Well, what's really the month look? Politicians become sophisticated. They ask the question, big sample size. Is it 200? Is it 1,000? I mean, it matters to them now because they understand the difference. And they look at who when the poll was taken. So was there a crisis, and then 4 days later was the poll taken and it out? Or was the poll taken, then the crisis, which hasn't had time to hit the people, and the numbers out? And they also look at, was it on the weekend or was it during the week? And so I would say conservatives, we always say, well, our guys are home on the weekend. So when pollers call on the weekend, none of our guys are answering the phone, so it's not really our guys answering the question. But that's some of the things that we look at, especially, we're out doing sports, we're out shopping, we're out with our families, we're doing fun. And I just do this to provoke Nick, because it's... But I guess my point is that politicians now look at the numbers and they do a little bit of pushback. And Nick was on TV and he explains it very well and what the numbers mean, when they were taken, how many people were spoken to. But politicians now, because there's so much numbering, there's so many numbers out there, there's so many people trying to break news, and the stories appear on the front page of the headline and they read, and then it's, you know, it's just a sample size, or it's a big poll and it's very complicated with lots of questions. Politicians wonder, what were the order of the questions? What kind of issues were discussed? We don't see the questions, we just see the answers. So I guess, Antonio, I would say politicians never ignore polls. They always want to know what's in the paper, what are the numbers, what do they say. But then they move on to what are the issues of the day, what do Canadians need, what's the question going to be like, you know, what am I doing, am I traveling? So it is one thing they consider, but it doesn't mean that a politician becomes paralyzed every day a poll comes out. They take it, they absorb it, and they move on.
Well, if I can just have the last word anecdotally, polls are now done online with every bit as much as accuracy as they're done by telephone, but there was a time polls were done at the door in person, and in some countries like Afghanistan and Iraq, they often still are because people don't have phones. And I was once at Francis Fox, I was having dinner in Ottawa when he was Minister of Communications in the Trudeau government, the night the Gallup poll actually came to his front door and asked him what party he was voting for and whether he was satisfied with the performance of the Prime Minister and whether he was satisfied or dissatisfied with the government. So this is what we call the margin of error that is sometimes built into polling. I want to thank our colleagues for putting on a great panel and you for being such a great audience at the end of all day.
Thank you very much, Ian. The good news is you passed the test. The good news is you passed the test. As director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, I can tell you that this is the first one of our conferences in which I've been riveted to my seat, and I don't usually ask that many questions at a conference, but it's been absolutely an exceptional day, one excellent panel after another. And when we imagined this conference on public policy as a bridge between our Max Bell project on innovation and implementation on public policy and an informed, engaged discussion on the real world of public policymaking, we couldn't have imagined the incredibly thoughtful and insightful comments and presentations of our panelists and audience. We've heard from politicians, ex-politicians, advisors, academics, policymakers, public servants, observers and shapers of public policy, and we, inside and outside that box, and we've learned, I think, a great deal about public policy in crisis, about the challenges of the public policy making policymaking process and about the challenges of making public policy in times of crisis. And we've had reassurances from the Minister of Finance, right? We've had insider views of what works and what happens and why. We've even had calls for a democratic revolution, I think I heard this morning. So I think we're on our way as we see. We had a reality check about who gets into that policy process and why. And we've had images of kitchen in all its messiness, but also all of its beauty. So it's been a great conference, and I hope that you have enjoyed it as much as I have, and that it's been a useful exercise for you. Before we leave, I just want to say, mesdames, messieurs, j'ai quelques remerciements à faire pour toutes les personnes qui sont responsables au succès de cette conférence. I'd like to thank the Max Bell Foundation for its generous support over the years, and the Max Bell Research Team, Natalie Cook, Chris Manfredi, Rick Schultz, Stuart Sorok, and Will Straw, the Max Bell Postdoctoral Fellows, including Shel Boyd, the Dean of Arts and the Dean of Arts Development Fund, MISC, or the McGill Institute for the State of Canada's Board of Trustees, and in particular our co-chair, Madame de Carré, who's been with us for the whole conference. I'd like to thank the conference steering committee, including Keith Banting, Ian Brody, Mel Kapp, Patrick Fard, Eric Montpetit, Wendy Thompson, Bill Watson, and Pascal Zamparelli, CPAC, the Faculty Club of Media Services. Stuart, we could not have done it without you. And, of course, most of all, our panelists, conference session chairs and speakers who have been incredibly generous with their time and, I think, incredibly frank with what they have to say. It really has been really wonderful to be able to bring together. And part of the best part of this day has been, and it was to hear interact with one another and with the audience. It's been really a privilege. I want to thank you very much. Most of all, I'd like to thank the students, all of our students in the audience, and also all the students who have worked for this conference. The audience participation has been wonderful. Thank you. You're so well behaved, too. Wow, we're really impressed. And finally, last but certainly not least, our équipe de tonnerre and McGill Institute for Study of Canada, Jean Bilodeau, Luc Moreau, Adriana Greta, Rachid Turcan, Patrick Boilly, and Emmanuel Richet. It's been a great conference. Thank you very much. Je vous invite maintenant à un cocktail d'ouverture. Merci et à la prochaine, je l'espère bien.